Very warm welcome to everybody, especially warm welcome to Madeline Reeves, who's joining us today from the University of Manchester, where she has been a senior lecturer for quite some time. Madeline and I share one alma mater, I was just really taking my daily steps into the discipline when Madeline, to say the kinship terms, my older sister, so to speak, was already leaving home. And since graduating from the University of Cambridge, Madeline has established herself as an astute and very prolific scholar of Central Asia, and mainly Kyrgyzstan, where she's been doing research for ever. And if there's a center around which her work circles, it is the question of state-making and statehood following the end of the Soviet Union. Her inquiries into sovereignty, citizenship, migration, and related issues emerge from and are grounded in, though we might say, banal realities of everyday life, where notions such as the state, the people, or the border unravel into very localized and frail efforts at giving the material shape, stabilizing, and fixing. And in her exceptionally deep and very thick and intricate ethnographies, we encounter politicians and bureaucrats, state employees and military personnel, students and villagers, workers and peasants, fathers and daughters, as they partake in desiring, imagining, construing, undoing, and withdrawing from different sites and fields of practice of the political. One of such sites, and the one that she will take us to today, is that of the referendum. The possibly devastating effects of this political device are painfully felt not only by those who observe or live through the absurd yet all too real-life theater of Brexit. In Turkey last year, a referendum buried a, in many ways, faulty yet still quite firmly established system of parliamentary democracy to give way to the spectacle of one-man rule. As Madeline notes in her talk today, populist authoritarian regimes love referendums precisely because they are exceptionally apt at conjuring the people, that the sovereign will, through the offer of a choice that is really often none. And thinking back to another referendum in Turkey in 2010 on changing the constitution, it triggered a great many people to a campaign slogan and a stance that was called Evet ama yetmez, which translates as yes, but it's not enough. So people were supporting the referendum, which was very much about curbing the power and influence of the military in Turkey. But of course, it was not enough. Yet of course, within the logics of a referendum, this not enough could not in any way be registered. So it kind of, went with the times. A recent referendum in Kyrgyzstan serves as occasion for Madeline today to think about refusal and the desire for non-politics. In a context where democracy appears to be mainly associated with political instability and insufficient statehood, the ballot can trigger fears about the eruption of potentially uncontainable social antagonisms. Madeline's engagement with, with the political thereby continues a threat that has emerged over the course of this colloquium, which is that of the political as disillusion. At least the contributions from the sort of post-Soviet sort of context seem to suggest that the gap between promise and reality of liberal democracy has widened in these settings beyond any possibility of being sutured. In the wake of this failure, the desire for a predictable life, for an intimate surrounding and the immediate future gets attached to strong states with the power to order and distribute. Besides her innumerable articles and individual chapters, Madeline has published a monograph, Border Works, Spatial Lives in the State of the State in Rural Central Asia in 2014, which has won several prizes, including one in 2015, one in 2016, and one in 2017, I realized. The last one being the past President's Gold Book Award from the Association of Borderland Studies. And yes, that we could maybe show this book around. She's also co-edited two volumes, one on ethnographies of the state in Central Asia and the other on movement, power and place, so in Central Asia. And she still, until this year, from what I understand, serves as the editor of a Central Asian Survey. And of course, there's many more things to be said, but I shall leave it at that and looking forward to listen to your talk.
Thank you for the introduction. I'm going to read a paper just to, in the hope of sticking to my allotted time. I'll just begin, though, by saying a little bit about the kind of context for this paper, in that it's somewhat unusual in that I didn't sort of set out with a project to think about referendums or about moments of political refounding. But unsurprisingly, living with Brexit for the last 2.5 years and trying to think about what's at stake when we make claims on behalf of the people, or when we make claims about the people have decided, I've become really interested in the question of what's at stake in that claim, but also what are the kinds of political technologies that produce this fictitious, singular, and very ephemeral we, the people. And I think referendums are particularly kind of interesting as anthropological objects in this sense, as sort of particular kinds of technologies for producing a momentary we that can be very politically efficacious, and that's one of the things that I want to explore in the Kyrgyzstan context, but which can also be very politically destructive, I think. And it's really a sort of, this paper is really the beginnings of an attempt to sort of think through what is sort of an anthropological inquiry about these moments of political founding might look like. So I will go ahead and read the paper. In September 2014, the History Department of Kyrgyzstan's National University welcomed delegates to a conference dedicated to assessing the legacy of perestroika in Central Asia. It was a formal occasion, bookended with official speeches by politicians who had been active in the Republic's life a generation earlier, so at the very end of the Soviet Union. Although I was there to present my research, I found myself the unexpected object of address during one of the opening speeches. The figure here on the left, and also here, is Mirikhan Sherimkulov. At 75 years old, he was the former first secretary of the Kyrgyz Communist Party at the end of the Soviet Union. So he was this former very significant political figure in the country. And I was sitting there listening to these opening speeches in a slightly sort of jet-lagged state. And then suddenly he turns to me as our English guest, as he described me, and spoke of some breaking news of which he had just learned and which he wanted to share with the auditorium. In the referendum on Scottish independence that had been held the previous day, the result was just in, he announced. He'd been looking at his smartphone. Scottish voters had narrowly voted to remain within the United Kingdom. Sherimkulov wanted publicly to congratulate me on this fortunate result, as he described it, and invited me spontaneously to address the gathered students on the importance, as he put it, of national unity. After all, he explained, recent events showed that Kyrgyzstan knew only too well the scourge of separatism, as he put it, an oblique reference to intercommunal violence that had affected Kyrgyzstan's two largest southern cities in 2010. Linking the Scottish independence referendum to the theme of the conference, our ostensible theme was perestroika in Central Asia, he then turned to the rows of seated undergraduates who you can see behind him on this photo. How might world events have turned out differently if, in 1989, Gorbachev hadn't ceded to the Baltic Republic's separatist demands, he asked, in so doing setting off a chain of events that led to the disintegration of that great state, to use the term Velikoe Gosudarstvo, the Soviet Union. And then he turned to the students. How will you, he challenged the students, work to defend Kyrgyzstan's statehood? Shemkulov's unexpected invitation to address the gathered students in my fog of jet lag left me searching for words. I had been agnostic on the question of Scottish independence, a ballot in which I was not entitled to vote as a resident of England. Nor did I share his stark assessment of the risk of regional separatism in Kyrgyzstan. I fumbled some non-committal words about democratic participation, noting that in a context where young people tend not to participate in the electoral process, it was refreshing to observe how Scottish 16 and 17-year-olds had been politicised by the referendum debate and the chance to vote. Whatever the result, I commented, skirting the question of the outcome, the referendum had been an important exercise in popular democracy. I didn't think much more about Shemkulov's comment or my hesitant response until 2.5 years later, so this was 2017 by this time, I came to share a meal with 22-year-old Viniera, one of the undergraduate students who had been in the audience that day. It was March 2017, and I had briefly returned to Bishkek, Kyrgyzstan's capital. 3 months earlier, in December 2016, Kyrgyzstani citizens had taken part in a referendum to pass a slate of amendments to the country's constitution. It was, in fact, its sixth constitutional referendum in 25 years of independence. Viniera had been active in the sizable activist community called Referendum Nyet, so no to the referendum in Russian, that had mobilized to argue against changing the constitution, sharing links and likes on the group's Facebook pages. She was fired up by this experience of online activism. Even though the referendum result, which had been an 80% vote in favor of the constitutional changes, was a source of bitter disappointment to her. This referendum wasn't about democracy, she told me over our meal in Bishkek. It was the work of unnamed aferisti, she used the term, con artists, who played upon social upheaval. This wasn't democracy, she said, but siyasat, a Kyrgyz term for politics that she used even though she was talking to me in Russian. She spat out the word like a curse. Viniera's emphatic disdain for the electoral process was far from unique among my informants at this time. In Kyrgyzstan, during 25 years of independence, there have been multiple attempts at refounding the political order through constitutional change. The most recent iteration, the 2016 referendum that was the focus of Viniera's ire, approved in a single yes-no vote a bundle of 26 changes to the 2010 constitution, which had in turn been introduced following a period of enduring social and political crises in the 2000s, when the state itself had at certain points been close to collapse. The 2010 constitution, which had been the object of intense deliberation and public debate, had authorized a fundamental change to the country's system of governance, from a presidential to a parliamentary system. Crucially, moreover, the 2010 version of the Constitution contained a clause prohibiting further amendments to the text of the document until 2020. Article 114, as it came to be known, was a clause intended to forestall further reworking of the Constitution and to protect its co-optation by partisan political interests. It was, in this sense, an attempt to build into the very wording of the Constitution a limit on its future unmaking. The proposed changes in 2016 signalled a return to a more emphatically presidential and centralised mode of governance, as well as a more explicitly ethno-national stress on national values. The revised preamble, for instance, stressed the importance of developing and strengthening Kyrgyz statehood, Kyrgyzskoye gosodarstvennost, and to a Russian-speaking audience, that would signal a particularly kind of ethnically marked sense of that statehood of the defined by the Kyrgyz ethnic group rather than all of the citizens of Kyrgyzstan, as well as protecting state sovereignty and the unity of the people and developing its language and culture as the highest goal of the constitution. Revisions to individual articles sought to diminish the power of the judiciary, by subjecting revisions of the constitutional chamber to the approval of the President and Parliament, and increasing the regulatory and monitoring powers of the security services. Further amendments gave the President the power to appoint and dismiss members of the constitutional chamber. One proposed amendment, the one that garnered the greatest international attention, explicitly prohibited same-sex marriage. For opponents of the 2016 referendum, such as Vieira, it was not just the substance of the amendments that was a source of concern, or the bundling of amendments to 26 distinct articles into a single ballot. It was also the fact that the existing 2010 constitution would be undermined in the very act of holding a referendum before the 10-year moratorium on further reworking was over. As our meal came to an end, Vieira reminded me of the remarks that I had made 2.5 years earlier at this conference where she was. "Remember when you told us about the Scottish independence referendum as being a victory for democracy?" she asked, her tone part teasing but part deadly serious. "Well, ha," she said, "you can put all the stuff you like into a, you can put all the stuff you don't want to debate into a referendum. Put something about national values at the top of the paper, and you can get the people to pass anything. I bet half the people didn't even read the ballot." So this paper is an attempt to think anthropologically about these moments of political refusal, and is prompted by Vieira's critique, her implied, though not verbalised, bullshit in response to my anodyne comments about democratic participation. Her accusation that this siyasat was a particularly fickle pretense of politics, a world in which con artists parade as the real thing and constitutions can be rewritten on a whim. The realm of politics, of course, is often seen as paradigmatically a realm of trickery and deceit, or the cunning of unreason, as John Donne called it in his sweeping history of political disillusion. Yet it's striking that anthropology has, in general, had much more to say about moments of political upheaval and political hope than with political refusal or regret. Perhaps this is because of the ethnographic seduction of those times and places when politics takes over the street and a barricade sociality, as Dudzinska and Arenas call it, consumes and momentarily transforms the body politic, making the people aware of itself as an ephemeral subject of politics. So this has certainly been true of the dominant anthropological literature about politics in Kyrgyzstan. There's been a lot of attention to student protest movements, for instance, sit-ins, road closures, these forms of kind of everyday political activism. Much less, I think, has been written about the desire for non-politics, about the refusal to vote, to protest, or to take one's discontent to the streets, the desire not to hold a ballot, or the refusal to take part in one. We know comparatively little about wariness towards political antagonism and the forms it takes, particularly after barricades have been dismantled and crowds dispersed, or about the shapes of political exhaustion after a period of devastating intercommunal violence has undone the dense fabric of relations in an ethnically mixed city. Yet over the 2 decades that I've been conducting research in Kyrgyzstan, moments of dramatic political upheaval, though they are many, have occurred in a context where the more commonly articulated concern is for political durability, of keeping the government, the parliament, and the state itself going in the face of multiple internal and external pressures. Indeed, it's such a concern for stability, I suggest, that was written into the 2010 constitution through a moratorium on further constitutional amendments for 10 years, which made the 2016 referendum so contentious. While the contours of this story are inseparable from the specifics of Kyrgyzstan's recent history, suspicions of political overspill have many global resonances. Vieira's cynicism about the true intentions behind an ostensibly democratic act echoes other voices about other elections, including those of anthropologists struggling to make sense of their own political disquiet in the face of divisive ballots. writing of the tense run-up to the Scottish independence referendum in 2014, for instance, Jonathan Spencer, a professor of anthropology who lives in Edinburgh, recalls what he calls the almost claustrophobic sense that there was too much politics, of political antagonisms spilling over into all areas of life, of every casual conversation being framed by the possibility of turning into a bitter political row, not least among close family and dear friends. In Remain voting circles following the UK Brexit referendum in 2016, the sense of betrayal by a political class that cared little for democracy was poignantly captured in the novelist Ali Smith's portrait of divisions as they coursed through families and communities, quote, as if a live electric wire had snapped off a pylon in a storm and was whipping about in the air above the trees, the roofs, the traffic. If elections are premised upon irreconcilable difference as the dynamic force of political life, a difference that necessitates mechanisms, however blunt, to channel and arbitrate between political interest, there is, I think, something quite distinctive about the referendum as a tool of political decisionism, one which anthropology hasn't yet had much, I think, to say, or as much as it could. Referendums are typically conducted in the interest of eliciting a moment of political closure through the explicit invocation of the people's will. In this lies both their power and their volatility. In Kyrgyzstan, as in the UK, for instance, it's striking that what crystallised in the wake of their respective referendums in 2016 was a nagging concern that the institution itself was not quite to be trusted, that certain questions should better not be put to a popular ballot. This was something other than, or more than, I think, mere disillusion or disappointment. It was the niggling sense that the ballot itself wasn't quite real, with a fictional choice masquerading as the real deal. It's these vernacular diagnoses and their responses that I want to foreground in the analysis that follows. Taking both the identification of political failure and its disavowal seriously as properly anthropological objects of inquiry. But it's also beyond that an attempt to think about the nature of the referendum as a distinctive kind of political device for conjuring the people. What makes a referendum as a distinct form of decisionism merely politics, in Vinera's words? What are the political excesses for which referendums are seen as the symptom? And what might such moments of diagnosis illuminate about authenticity and duplicity as they circulate as figures of hope and derision in political life? To unpack these ideas, I want to turn a little more to the case of Kyrgyzstan, and in particular, the ambivalent resonances of siyasat, this term for politics that Vinera used, and that she used with a real kind of disdain. So this section is called Siyasat and Political Refusal in Kyrgyzstan. Visitors to Kyrgyzstan will often hear that the country's politics are nothing like those of its neighbours. Sometimes this is recounted as a statement of pride or defiance. Here we can criticise the president, I was often told, but you tried doing that in Uzbekistan. Sometimes it's explained as the inheritance of nomadic Kyrgyz culture, which valued freedom and never looked too kindly on overlords. Sometimes it takes the form of self-deprecating jokes or unlikely international records that Kyrgyzstan has amended its constitution more times and in a shorter period than any other state, for instance, or that it has had more presidential candidates running in a single election per capita than any other state. Whatever the empirical veracity of these claims, their circulation as truth statements is significant. Political failure in Kyrgyzstan is widely identified as a failure of excess. The tone of such observation is often ambivalent. The recognition of greater public freedom, coupled with a lament that Kyrgyzstan lacks a transparent vertical of power, unlike Russia, or the oil-powered infrastructural reach of the Kazakhstani state, its larger neighbour to the north. In this diagnosis, democracy is less a sign of success than an artifact of failing state reach or a mark of political instability. For scholars too, Kyrgyzstan's democratic exceptionalism has been the subject of extensive commentary. In a region often associated with an excess of political continuity, symbolized by aging presidents for life and non-competitive elections, Kyrgyzstan has experienced dramatic political upheavals, competitive elections, two revolutions, one in 2005, the other in 2010, and extrajudicial transfers of power, just as it has violent crackdowns on the political opposition and the consolidation of an oligarch class. Kyrgyzstan's political experiments have been variously characterized as an index of democratic success, or more often as the index of the progressive hollowing out of a state that has little administrative or distributional capacity. Johan Engvall has characterized the Kyrgyzstani state as essentially what he calls an investment market, where political office is bought and sold to the highest bidder. Boris Pipik, an anthropologist, in a scathing critique of what he calls the NGOization of the political field, has argued that Kyrgyzstan is better characterized not as a state at all, but as what he calls a globalized protectorate. Both its exceptionalism in the Central Asian context and its extremely unstable recent political history have fostered a distinctive public sphere in Kyrgyzstan, one in which foundational questions of what it is to be sovereign or independent or democratic, what it means for the state to have the attributes of legitimacy or territorial integrity or constitutionality, or what it would mean for the ethnic Kyrgyz to feel themselves to be masters in their own land, are live in everyday conversation and liable to spring to the surface of otherwise routine matters. Public debate over whether Kyrgyzstan should join the Eurasian Customs Union, which it eventually did in August 2015, for instance, was characterized not primarily by concerns regarding the economic advantages and disadvantages of membership, but about whether joining would undermine Kyrgyzstani sovereignty. In 2006, the Kyrgyzstan government had refused to join the World Bank's program for highly indebted poor countries for the same reason, with politicians and civil society activists alike demonstrating outside the World Bank offices and setting alight a banker effigy complete with top hat to protest what they called the strangled hold of democracy that the program would entail. Nor is such sovereignty concern confined to the capital city or the political elite. During my fieldwork in southern Kyrgyzstan, I encountered plenty of discussion of bread and butter politics, particularly as this pertained to the relative distribution of wealth between the north and the south of the country. Yet what I hadn't anticipated was quite how much sovereignty talk I would encounter, quite so much commentary, in other words, on what it was to be or to have or to fail to have territorial integrity, international legibility, and a functioning responsive state to which one is legible, and which is in turn legible to the population in the figure of the policeman and pensions and asphalted roads. These questions had an intensity and urgency to them born of recent political crises. In the wake of years of political upheaval, Kyrgyzstani citizens had become accustomed to commentary on their state as a prospective failed state. In Russian, it's несостоявшееся государство, or literally a non-existent state. It has this kind of real intensity to it. Or of being unable to sustain parliamentary democracy, as Dmitry Medvedev had notoriously claimed in 2010. And although such external commentary was often dismissed by my urban acquaintances as the ill-informed or condescending imperial attitude of Russian politicians who were unable to accept that other states could determine their own political futures, in rural Batken, many of my informants seemed to concur with the assessment that elections risked igniting social tensions that were never far from the surface, setting in motion social antagonisms that could not then be easily contained. In this context, refusal to participate in demonstrations and strikes, refusal to participate in elections or to give away one's vote for a promise of material reward, are acts, I think, that need to be situated within a register of ethics and sociality, just as much as more demonstrative acts of collective participation. To illustrate, I'm going to turn to two ethnographic examples from my fieldwork, a decade apart. So the first is from 2005 in a village I'm calling Torozbulak, which is a pseudonym, which is in the Batken district in the south of the country, right up on the border with Tajikistan. But it's a Kyrgyz, it's an exclusively Kyrgyz-speaking village. So June 2005, school is out, but Bakut Akay, who is here on the photo, a teacher of Russian language and literature in his late 50s, is in his classroom whitewashing the walls. The paint has been paid for by his pupils' parents, and Bakut Akay is responsible for overseeing the annual process of remont, or school repairs. He covers up the wall-sized painting of Pushkin, which is in his Russian literature classroom, to protect it from splashes of paint, shouting orders to the parents and former pupils who are helping in this annual ritual of renovation. Bakut Akay is exhausted, and not just by the endless paper and repair work that consumes his summer days. Many of his colleagues have left to work in Russia, and for the first time, he is considering leaving too. He hasn't received his full salary for months, and even with a lengthy teaching service and a double load of classes, it's hard to make ends meet. The new government, he tells me, doesn't have cash to pay teachers, or so they say, though they had cash to give us before the elections. In this border village, where tensions over water and land often run close to the surface of daily interaction, election time can be fraught. The last election, 4 months earlier, was followed by street protests in Bishkek and provincial capitals that had seen the overthrow of the then president, Askar Akayev, in a dramatic popular coup. These events had also divided the village between those who supported the local candidate in the parliamentary elections and those who favoured the more prominent leaders of the political opposition. At the time of our conversation in 2005, the self-declared leader of the People's Movement of Kyrgyzstan, Kurmanbek Bakiyev, had not yet been sworn in as president, and the hastily convened interim government was struggling to contain a wave of looting that had accompanied the March 2005 overthrow of former President Akayev. He was also struggling to pay state salaries, including Bakut Akay's own. In the past, he had already been paid by the start of the holidays, he told me, but in June he was still awaiting his salary from March. Bakut Akay's reflections on the economic woes quickly morphed into a broader commentary on the demands of political participation, particularly in a village such as his, where histories of compulsory resettlement meant that no single lineage, or uru in Kyrgyz, dominated. After the whitewashing was finished for the day, Bakut Akay invited me to take a seat at the back of his classroom, where he explained his exhaustion with siyasat through reference to the elections that had taken place in February that year, precipitating the political crisis that had continued to consume the country. So this is Bakut Akay speaking. Here, for instance, people wanted Dospol Nur Ulu as their parliamentary deputy. He's got relatives here, but he didn't get through because he couldn't get enough votes. Why? Because there were others. They're in Batken, they're different from us. They have their own relatives. You see, it's a bad habit we've got, these old holdovers. We've got relatives, you know. You have to know your seven fathers. And so Dospol Nur Ulu had his relatives here, but in Batken, well, they're Kipchaks. You know Kipchaks, right? And they said they wanted a Kupchak to get through. Usually it's a Kupchak who wins there. But here we're Avat, right? Our lineage is different, and that's important. Because over there, there are lots of them in Batken. But here, the lineages are small. Inside Avat, you've got Tokmok, Bujo, Keje, lots of sub-lineages, nine of them. At election time, we all end up dividing. We have that kind of mentality. That's how we've survived. The one who's closer, you can trust him more. And then we call this democracy. For Bakut Akay, this anxiety about political fragmentation translated into an emphatic refusal to take part in the demonstrations that had been plaguing other parts of the country since the spring. Some of his relatives had tried to persuade him to come to the district centre, Batken, at election time to voice his support for the new southern leader of the country, Kurmanbek Bakiyev. But Bakut Akay refused. "I've got children to teach," he commented indignantly of his emphatic non-participation in the March rallies. He continued, If an enemy turns up here, then I'll be ready to fight. But what about those in power? What need have I to fight them? The problem now is that no one even listens to the law any longer. One guy gets into power, he's correct, they say. Another guy gets into power and brings along his own constitution. He's correct, they say. And where's the law in this? Where's the continuity? It's not clear what will happen. Maybe there'll be anarchy in the future. Who can say? Even at a time when others were celebrating the success of a popular uprising in removing President Akayev and his so-called family government, Bakatai was anticipating the political disillusion that many came to feel only later. Yet Bakatai's was not just disillusion with corrupt elites. In his account of Siyasat, the problem is not just the capacity of elections to channel and solidify social divisions that were otherwise muted in daily life, but the ability of those thus elected to appropriate the law in their own favour, to the extent that even the constitution then is treated as a private document to be changed at whim. Indeed, these two dimensions of Siyasat were profoundly linked in his account. It was the very tendency for the powerful to appropriate the constitution and then to claim in a sleight of hand that this is the will of the people, he's correct, that magnified social tensions by exposing the necessary gap between democracy's promise and its murky realization. My second ethnographic example comes from another mountain village a decade later, this time 2015, and a little bit further along, also in Batken region, but maybe about 50 kilometers further down the valley. Unlike Tolz Bulak, Çeçme is a Tajik-majority village, tucked into a mountain gorge, and spatially contiguous with a Kyrgyz-majority village with which it constitutes a single administrative district. As in villages up and down the country, private buildings on Çeçme's central street have been turned into the local headquarters for the main political parties that are competing here. This is September 2015. Fabric banners, such as this one advertising Atam Eken, one of the political parties, hang from shop windows to advertise their new role. As a decade earlier, there are sponsored concerts by visiting pop stars in the local administrative centre. There are promises of pay rises and deliveries of coal. School gymnasiums, which will serve as polling stations on election day, are being hastily cleaned ahead of the October 4th parliamentary elections. But the political mood here was subdued. Siyasat, as Jamilia, an elderly mother of four grown children, commented as we waited together at the village taxi rank, just divides people, she said. She wouldn't be voting, she confided. One neighbour wants you to vote one way because they have a brother who is working in the Stab in the headquarters. Another says vote for Atatürk because their people are from the south. She sucked her cheeks and muttered a bismillah under her breath before switching subjects. The topic was clearly one that she didn't want to discuss further. For prominent members of Çeçme's Tajik minority, such as Ikram here, another pseudonym, the election carried an extra burden of scrutiny. Ikram was the 31-year-old administrative director of Çeçme's Tajik medium school and a member of the village council. He was seething when I saw him about an incident that had occurred 2 days earlier. The school's Aktor Vizal, its sports hall, which doubled as a meeting house and a polling booth, was constantly being appropriated by the regional administration for a multitude of pre-election trainings, and this was messing with the school's timetable. They treat it as though it were their property, he complained. When he asserted politely but firmly his pupils' right to conduct their sports lessons in peace, he'd been given a public dressing down by the deputy governor of the regional administration. Elections are important, the deputy governor had told him. And so is my pupil's education, Ikram had replied. And then, of course, they tell me to curb my temper, to calm myself. So do my colleagues. But they're stirring things up with this election. Ikram was also being pressed upon as a respected member of his community to mobilize the vote for particular candidates. The day before I met him, he had gone to one of the local roadside shops to drink coffee and eat a snack with his colleagues between class. In fact, it's this little cafe here that's next to the big sign. The owner had gently refused his attempts to pay. On leaving the shop, however, the man who had served the coffee, the delegated village campaign manager for one of the main opposition parties, teased Ikram with the comment, "Don't forget whose coffee you've just drunk." Although couched as a gentle joke, Ikram interpreted this comment from someone who, as he put it, wasn't even a friend, just an acquaintance. He interpreted it as a thinly veiled demand for political loyalty, a prospective buying of his vote through an ostensibly generous gesture of coffee and cake. Ikram was irate. He did not immediately respond to the gesture, aware of the presence of his older colleagues and bound by a sense of deference towards them to avoid demonstrative behaviour. The next day, however, after teaching three classes, he bought a jar of Nescafe, not an inconsequential purchase on his teacher's salary, and slammed it demonstratively on the shop counter in the cafe-turned-election office, announcing pointedly, "Here's the coffee that I drank yesterday. Don't think I'll sell you my vote." These two examples from two Batken villages 10 years apart are striking, I think, for the way in which an election figures discursively as a particularly consequential and prospectively divisive public exercise, one that can make otherwise muted social divisions the object of intense popular investment. Here, as in Spencer's evocation of the deeply embodied sense of there being too much antagonism in pre-referendum Scotland, we have the discomfort of too much politics, of antagonisms being whipped about and charging through the social fabric with unpredictable consequences. In each case, we also have the sense that the ballot itself is, if not a sham, inadequate to capture the variety of interests that are circulating in society and the personalisation of the state by those in power. It's significant in this respect that it was similar fears over the co-optation of democracy by partisan interests that had underpinned calls for the constitutional change of 2010, a change that would bring about a parliamentary democracy as opposed to a presidential one. After two revolutions in 5 years, and the ousting of President Bakiyev, so that the second coup that had got rid of Kyrgyzstan's second president since independence, the hope invested in rewriting the constitution by the ad hoc provisional government and its unlikely leader, Roza Otunbayeva, was that by changing from a presidential to a parliamentary system, the antagonisms that had been manifest on the streets might be contained within the political process itself. That a constitutional referendum, even in a condition of political crisis, might refound the rule of law. In 2010, the primary concern of the provisional government in rewriting the constitution was to prevent a counter-coup by supporters of ousted President Bakiyev or members of the president's political party. But it was also more fundamentally an experiment in refounding constitutional order in a context of legal exception. The 2010 referendum had included three motions bundled together into a single vote. A yes vote would mandate simultaneously to approve the draft constitution and the law on its enactment, to confirm Roza Otunbayeva as interim president until December 31st, 2011, and to dismiss the judges of the Constitutional Court. But refounding the law when one's very claim to government to govern is not yet recognised is a messy business. The provisional government, after all, had popular legitimacy, but no juridical foundation. One of the interim government's first acts, and they were acting here in decree, Provisional Government Decree Number 8, as it was called, which was took place a day after the former president was overthrown, was to issue a resolution indicating that its decrees would henceforth have normative force. This act was itself illegal according to the 2009 Law on Normative Acts. This was followed on April the 10th by decrees dissolving Parliament and disbanding the Constitutional Court, the only institution mandated to oversee the constitutionality of legal acts. So we've got this complete sort of legal vacuum going on. Decrees numbers 19 and 20, which mandated the holding of a referendum, stated that constitutional laws would guide the administration of the constitutional referendum unless they contradicted the provisional government's own decrees. So we've got sort of the hierarchy where the provisional government's decrees have a higher force than any legal provisions. The OSCE that was monitoring events noted rather obliquely in its report on the constitutional referendum that this was a vote in which, as they put it, the legal framework for the constitutional referendum failed to fully regulate the process. This was an emphatic understatement. The provisional government was governing by decree in a state of emergency. Appealing to the will of the people at this time was perhaps both necessary and inevitable, for this was the only source of authority left in the absence of a legally recognised government. But for all the provisional government's appeals to people's democracy, народная демократия, the people of Kyrgyzstan was at this time emphatically not cohesive. For weeks, Kyrgyzstan was effectively living in a state of emergency, with the ultimate source of legitimate authority contested locally between supporters of the ousted president, supporters of the interim government, and supporters of local governors who often acted as de facto sovereigns in their region of jurisdiction. Control of local mayoral offices changed hands repeatedly during these first weeks of power, and the justice was often very rough indeed. More worrying still, between June the 10th and the 14th, just 2 weeks before the constitutional referendum was due to be held, the provincial centres of Osh and Jalalabad, the two largest cities in the south of the country, were racked by intercommunal violence in which 400 people were killed. This polarised the cities along lines of ethnicity and residence, leaving hundreds killed and tens of thousands displaced. In this fraught setting, the 2010 referendum took on colossal significance, even and perhaps especially because there was so little certainty over whether it could be held at all. Thousands of ethnic Uzbeks who had fled their homes were still sheltering in refugee camps across the border in Uzbekistan on the date scheduled for the referendum. Others were too terrified to leave homes and barricaded mahallas to take part in the vote. This was an inauspicious moment then to be conjuring up the people. And yet for Kyrgyzstani citizens, the vote was a moment of explicit and ritualized refounding of the polity and freighted with existential significance. It did more or less achieve what it set out to do, formalizing the provisional government as the single uncontested governing authority and refounding the constitution itself as the foundational text of law. The official turnout of 72% and a 90.55% vote in favour of the referendum are almost certainly inflated. Nonetheless, the 2010 referendum succeeded, materially and symbolically, as a moment of constitutional refounding. In a situation where the state faced a real threat of civil war, the referendum conjured a momentary and fragile we, a people who, as a provisional singularity, were able to reauthorize democratic politics and reground the constitution as the urtext of political life. It's in this context, I suggest, that we need to understand the post-revolutionary exhaustion that has characterized Kyrgyzstan's third decade of independence and the widely held sense that the country has, as I was often told, had enough of politics. The 2010 referendum had helped contain a political crisis and refound the constitution as the basis of state law. Indeed, it was quite possibly what helped in the crisis-filled summer of 2010 to avert a descent into further violence. The provisions internal to the document to prevent constitutional changes for a further 10 years reflected that concern, as did the prayerful reverence with which the 2010 constitution was treated in public discourse. But the sense that the political was intrinsically volatile, that divisions might once again go cursing through society, pitching neighbour against neighbour as had occurred in 2010, was never far from the surface. That's why subsequent political initiatives, including the attempted amendments of 2016, elicited such an outcry. Why a movement against a referendum should have popular appeal. Tinkering with the constitution, as one Bishkek analyst commented in 2017, was like playing with fire. Indeed, it's striking that when parliamentary elections were held in Kyrgyzstan in 2015, that the elections for which this banner was there, and this was the first major election since the political crisis of 2010, the greatest achievement, according to the then president, was that they had been held, as he put it, without a single demonstration, without a single person protesting. After the intense turmoil of the preceding years, the greatest ambition for the election was that it could pass almost unnoticed by the voting public and the outside world. So, some concluding thoughts. Democracy, and in particular the putative global crisis of democracy, has gained new attention as an object of anthropological inquiry in recent years. While much of the sociological and political science literatures on democracy has been concerned with normative questions of democratic success and failure, measured through rates of civic participation, tallies of regime type, or indices of political outcomes, anthropologists have tended to explore democracy instead within matrices of sociality and ethics. That is, as a form of practice and ideal that is necessarily both historically embedded and freighted with normative expectations of what participatory politics is or could be. The case of Kyrgyzstan's recent electoral history is instructive, I suggest, for thinking ethnographically about the complex relationship between political investment and political refusal. For non-participation, as much as participation itself, is also an ethical claim, a claim not to be corrupted, perhaps, or compromised, not to be complicit in an action that is not in one's name, not to be taken in by fakes. Refusal, too, is a political act, not just to resist, but to cut a relation, as Ikrom emphatically did, by returning the politically loaded gift of coffee that he was offered at election time. The examples explored here also provide an opening for considering the particular kinds of tensions intrinsic to the political form of the referendum. Referendums, after all, are very particular kinds of ballots. In part, this is because they're typically invoked to decide foundational political questions, to keep the constitution or change it, to accept the peace deal or to reject it, to call sovereignty or to take back control. The efficacy of the referendum lies precisely in its claim to demonstrate the unmediated will of the people in an imagined binary form, irrespective of how close the outcome or how polarized the preceding debate. They are, in that sense, the ultimate vehicles for legitimizing foundational acts, such as binding peace treaties or constitutional change by appeal to a sovereign national will. Referendums, then, more than any other democratic acts, have the capacity to cut the network, in Marilyn Strathern's term, to mark a temporal break, to refound the political order. In Kyrgyzstan, this is precisely what made the 2010 referendum efficacious, despite deep political crisis. But it's for this very same reason, I think, that referendums can prove so contentious, so liable to dismissal as fakes, so shot through with awareness of being straitjacketed into a choice that doesn't really feel like a choice at all. These features make the referendum the political tool par excellence of authoritarian populisms, as Alice pointed out in the case of Turkey, but we might also think of the referendum that legitimated the takeover of the Crimea, for instance. They are the vehicle through which to normalize a contested seizure of territory, to extend presidential terms, expand executive powers, or bypass parliamentary elections. Yet merely to recognise that referendums can be manipulated by political elites is to perhaps buy too readily into the kind of sleight of hand that they seem to enact. For as complex and contingent socio-technical forms, referendums are also indeterminate. Their outcome is never entirely knowable. It's this volatility, I suggest, that makes them particularly interesting anthropological objects. For referendums rupture the normal socio-material field, creating the opportunity for a moment of collective political diagnosis, in which the figure of the people acquires a sudden shimmering intensity, exposing in that moment the artifice at the heart of all sovereign claims. It's this intensity that can produce the efficacy of the referendum, its capacity drastically to change a political order, to authorise a government as legitimate, to sanctify a seizure of territory, or to restore normal politics as occurred in Kyrgyzstan in 2010, after 5 years of upheaval and a spring of unprecedented political violence. It's this that can constitute an awareness of peoplehood as an effervescent and potentially powerful subject of politics. But it's also this very moment of conjuring that can foster the sense of politics as the field par excellence of the sanctioned lie, at the choice being a fake, at the institution itself being unable to contain the volatile forces that it sets in motion. For the exposed to public scrutiny, not just the tension between democracy as ideal, the people shall govern themselves, and democracy as a messy, compromised, mediated reality. Do you prefer unsatisfactory option A or unsatisfactory option B? Referendums also shed a rare spotlight on that fickle, necessarily exclusive and emphatically non-unanimous thing, the people, who, as a fictive singularity, is used to ground the state's political sovereignty. It's this very challenge of foundationality, the prompt towards a meta-reflection on the messy, compromised, individual, all-too-human process through which sovereignty gets done, that makes these political acts at once good to think with about the state of contemporary democracy, and which makes them necessarily saturated with the suspicion of being not quite all that they seem. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Madeline. I would have lots to say and lots to ask, but we can just do that later, so please come forth with your thoughts and your questions.
This isn't very thought out, but referendums, yeah, they occupy me. And I have to say, whenever I hear Theresa May use that phrase, the will of the people, my blood absolutely boils. I feel like there's something in it that is very important about political form. So if you're a political scientist, I was wondering what maybe would get added into the question. You mentioned some things, but there is something also about form that they've thought about, because referenda can work in very different ways. It can be, who gets beyond 50%, or they could be set, as it could have been for Brexit, that you have to have three-quarters or even at least half of the population voting. So there's a whole set of things about rules that I kind of felt needs to be there somewhere. And then when I was thinking about your Kyrgyzstan example, so you said that they have this inherent volatility, but you could make it less volatile by these statistical means. But there, what was it, 99% of people did vote as expected. So I wondered, what did it really have that built in? So just wondered about the sort of, I can see why you want to pull them together. Mostly, I absolutely agree. And yet I felt that, there's something a little bit more detailed there that needs to be there too.
Yes. No. Thanks for that. I mean, this. I said to Alicia when I was sort of that this paper, in a way, was a response to an itch, and the itch was as much about kind of what's happening in the UK and my own sense of exactly frustration at that claim that the referendum it illuminates the will of the people. Like, what's at stake in that claim, and why do I feel? Not just that I disagree with that claim, but that claim is itself a kind of political fiction, right? That there's a sort of, and it's so it started out very much in that way. But I sort of wanted to move beyond my own feeling of frustration, not least because there are many global situations, and the Kyrgyz case is the 2010 referendum, I think, is one of them, where a referendum, that moment of producing that political fiction, right, the will of the people, has a kind of particular sort of political efficacy to authorise a peace deal, for instance, or in this case to kind of refound a political order after a period of revolution. And I think that the form is important. I mean, I think that, there are, of course, not all referendums are alike, and that part of the sort of violence of certain kinds of referendums is either because, in fact, what's being presented as a choice isn't really a choice, or because the conditions in which that vote is being conducted are themselves so coercive that it has no meaningful element of real choice. If I think of the case of the Crimea referendum, for instance, I mean, the conditions under which that was conducted obviated the sense of this being some kind of open choice. So there's, I think that the rules, I think that the rules do make a difference. I'm a Swiss citizen as well as a British citizen, and every 6 weeks I get a ballot through the post in French inviting me to take part in a referendum in Switzerland, and I always feel, again, slightly ambivalent about this, because there are many residents of Switzerland who don't have this right. But what's interesting there is that the ballot is always accompanied by a little booklet detailing the precise change to the legislation that's being enacted, so that it's although there's a kind of often an intensely political element to the vote, particularly as they often arise out of popular initiatives, what you are voting on is in fact incredibly specific. It's a specific legislative change, and so I think that matter of form also matters in terms of what is what's on the ballot paper. But I do find it interesting as an anthropological phenomenon. I mean, that globally there's an increased use of referendums as particular kinds of political tools, and I do think that warrants some kind of exploration. I think that there's some kind of particular tie-in with forms of democratic populism, for instance, because they can seem the most democratic act and therefore incontrovertible. And at the same time that they can be experienced as profoundly undemocratic. And that's the element that kind of interests me. I think there are particular, let's say, family affinities with certain forms of contemporary neoliberalism, the illusion of choice, for instance, that I think are worth exploring. I mean, I'm just kind of beginning on this exploration, so I'm very curious to get sort of feedback. But I think that there's something quite interesting about this political moment where referendums seem to have a kind of political efficacy in many, many settings.
Well, thank you for your presentation. I thought it was very interesting, especially the vignettes where you explored the playmaking and the effective engagement this moment, this referendum provoked in people. So what I'm wondering is, how do you see non-politics? Because for me, refusal is a way of engaging. And so how does this claim making and effective engagement actually translate in some sort of particular political practice? And how, for example, the two examples you gave in the vignette, did those people vote? Or refuse to go to the ballot? How does that translate into effective disengagement or like a refusal by refusing into? And the second thing goes about the possible efficaciousness, or how you call it that way. For my understanding, think of how do you analyze that? How efficacious that is, in terms of the consequences, right? So what kind of consequences does this this referendum have on the particular state or the particular political entity that comes out
in Kyrgyzstan? Thanks. Really helpful and thought-provoking questions, because I think that I've been thinking a lot about whether refusal is the right term for me to be using. Because in some ways I think, I agree with you that refusal itself can be a political act, and I think in both of the ethnographic examples I gave, that's how my interlocutors kind of saw it, that they were making a kind of positive claim about this non-participation, right? Either either a refusal to be corrupted by somebody who's purchased by having your vote bought, or a refusal to participate in a demonstration. And in both cases, to my knowledge, they both voted. I wasn't there on election day in either case. Well, I was in this case, but I don't know whether he voted. I'm pretty sure he did. I think this. So I agree that refusal is agentive. It's not just a sort of. And that's why I sort of want to think of this as something other than just disillusion. That there's political disillusion here, but there's something else that's a kind of site of active reflection about what would not participating in this political field look like. But at the same time, there is also a great deal of just political exhaustion. There's a great deal of sort of sense of, oh, another election, because this is so costly and this is so disruptive and this so messes up with daily life. And I think perhaps there's maybe a risk in my paper that I conflate those two and that I need to sort of separate them out, because I think both things are going on, and they're going on perhaps at different political moments for different people, but also differently for different for different generations, that for some people just really sort of are exhausted with politics and kind of opt out altogether. Others are much more sort of deliberate in their acts of refusal. So I think that's very, very useful for thinking about that. And in terms of this question of efficacy, in what sense was it efficacious? I mean, in the specific case of the 2010 referendum, I think there was a political efficacy, I would say, in the sense that this act did manage to the referendum, or this appeal to the people as the source of the ultimate source of sovereignty, in a context where there was no government that was legally recognised, there was no constitutional court, all of the sort of institutional forms of the state had been undermined. But in that situation, appealing to the ultimate sovereignty of the people and the means of doing that being through the election, through the referendum, I think proved efficacious to the extent that it put an end to a moment of profound political crisis where there were multiple competing sovereigns, essentially, in the local mayor of a given city and so on, and did assert the authority of the previously provisional government as the government, which could then authorise future normative acts. So I think in that sort of immediate sense, it was efficacious in that it forestalled a further kind of continuation of political violence. But I think, if I hear your question correctly, it's kind of how in general do we measure political efficacy? And I think that's a really interesting question. If we approach it from a sort of non-normative question, that it's often very, very hard to say. And one person's, that one person's political outcome may be highly efficacious, when for somebody else it's disastrous. And I think that's important to bring sort of ethnographic sensitivity to that, and I guess that's why I haven't wanted to write a sort of a polemical paper against referendums in general. I've been really wanting to try to think through what does this political act do, and I think it's very specific to particular contexts. What does it enact in a particular setting, and that really warrants ethnographic attention. And I think in certain cases it can be experienced as efficacious, and that we can think about, the kinds of claims that people make about what they understand to be efficacious, or contrastively, what they understand to be really destructive to the political field.
I'm wondering what kind of alternatives to referenda in these cases in Kyrgyzstan did you see that should have been or could have been there? Especially given the lack of viable democratic alternatives that the region offers in Kyrgyzstan in that case,
Yeah, it's a very, very interesting question. I mean, like I say, in 2010, I think simply holding a general election or a ballot or a presidential election probably wouldn't have had the same sort of claim to a foundational political act. But I think in 2016, so the example that I started with of this, the referendum to then change the constitution once again, I think an alternative would simply to have not, to have, well, for starters, not to have bundled 26 different decisions into one ballot, because in a sense you had one choice, yes, no, do you change all of these 26 things or none of them? So even at that level of you know, the possibility that you might agree with one or disagree with others was undermined, and a lot of people claimed that the statement about removing the possibility of or explicitly prohibiting same-sex marriage, when there had been no statement about same-sex marriage in the previous iteration of the Constitution, it had just been a non-issue. But sort of, it was seen that putting that item into the ballot, which would be one that a lot of people in Kyrgyzstan would agree with, was a means by which people would agree to all the 25 other items on the list. So I think that there could have been alternatives to that. I think there could have been alternatives. I think that the alternative would have been to respect the article of the 2010 constitution that said this constitution cannot be changed until 2020. Because what that did, again, was to re... If 2010, sort of that election, that constitutional referendum, re-founded the significance of the constitution itself as the foundational political act and beyond politics, in a sense, not open to, you know, constant change and renegotiation. And it tried to build into the wording a prohibition on its future reworking. The 2016 referendum totally undermined that. So it sort of devalued the constitution as a political act by saying, oh, well, actually we can change the wording and we can tinker with it and we can ignore the fact that we're not supposed to hold another election until 2020. So I think it opens up this really fascinating question about the sort of these moments of political desire and of non-political desire or desire for a certain kind of non-politics, because that was actually what was being played out in 2016, was a claim over do we have to have another election about this? And in fact, I think what a lot of people were arguing at the time was, no, it would be much, much better to allow the constitution, in a sense, to gain its authority by its durability.
Little remarks on this. Thank you for the presentation. First, I'm wondering if there's not two papers in one here, because there's one part on the constitution, on the referendums, where there's a lot of material on where the history of referendums, overall, how it works as an anthropological object. And here you could also compare the two referendums that Kyrgyzstan had, the 2010-2016 one, which are in fact very different from each other. The last one has been widely forgotten ever since, I would say. Even when the articles were implemented, no one talked about it anymore. And if it can be seen as an attempt of the president to keep his power after his term, one could also say that it failed in that sense because of the current situation. And the second part, which I also find very interesting, is about this democratic refusal, as you say, this concept of siyasat, which is more of an everyday thing in Kyrgyzstan. And so we have one part which pictures exceptional moments of politics, and the other which picture everyday life in Kyrgyzstan, which maybe do not relate to each other that much.
Yeah. Thank you. That's really helpful. It's also something I'm currently revising this paper for publication, and that's something I've been asking myself. So I really appreciate that critique, because I think it's very legitimate. I think I would still like them to be part of the same story. So perhaps the provocation for me is to think about in what sense are these two things part of the same story, and how could I bring that out more explicitly. The reason that I think that they're part of the same story, at least in the Kyrgyzstan context, is that there is a particular sense in which the exhaustion with politics, I think, although, yes, these referendum kind of elections are very, very particular political moments, I think they speak to, and I think the kind of contention surrounding them, particularly in 2016, the contention surrounding the very holding of that referendum was tied to a feeling of politics being a realm of excess in Kyrgyzstan, and an exhaustion with that excess, and a sort of being troubled by the fact that Kyrgyzstan's kind of democratic effervescence, so the fact that, for instance, there have been more people on the ballot per capita as running for president than any other country, apparently. I've tried to verify this. It's pretty difficult to kind of verify in any absolute terms, but many, 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 many people running for president, many, many people running for parliamentary election. But there is this kind of simultaneous pride around that and a sort of anxiety that this isn't normal, that there's a kind of political excess that's built into the political culture and built into political institutions that constantly needs to be curbed, and that this excess is the source of a lot of sort of volatility and instability. So I think that those stories and the kind of the use of referendums as a sort of particular attempt to kind of tame the political, let's say, are potentially linked. But I think I need to do more work to kind of pull those stories out, that pull the links out more explicitly, and maybe I do just need to kind of really like tear these two papers apart and put them into two different papers. But I'll certainly take that as an invitation to kind of think about why I want them to be part of the same story more explicitly. So thank you.
Okay, yeah, thanks. I have two questions. One is that I'm kind of used to consider political refusal as problematic, in that sense that a certain political process or a certain system might be dysfunctional or not open enough to include everybody. And I had to think about two examples. On the one hand, these debates about absence in France or in Germany of certain social groups in elections, not taking part in elections that they don't disclose, could be one theory of the cultural or social capital to take part in it. And another example that came to my mind was Arjun Appadurai's reference to Hirschman's to the American sociologist in his text, The Capacity to Aspire. At the beginning, he refers to this idea of the American sociologist Hirschman, that there are basically three options how to position to a political process, and one being a voice, and one being exit, and the third one, unfortunately,
loyalty. Exit, voice, loyalty.
Loyalty, okay. And he basically argues that we should think about how to bring people that choose exit, or I don't know if choose is the right word, that are rather in a position of exit to a position of bringing up their voice. I was wondering, as a way of being included in the political process, and I was wondering how your concept of political refusal is related or different to that kind of debates and reflections. And if I may, a second question, because you said somehow that some people consider the specific forms of democracy in Kyrgyzstan as signs of a failing state, is that right? And I was just wondering, and if I understood you correctly, this is something to do in this interpretation, that Kyrgyzstan hasn't oil or something like this, a certain elite might be interested, an authoritarian elite might be interested to basically monopolize the access to. And I was just wondering if you could reflect a little bit if after the Soviet Union, this part of Central Asia, different formations of statehood emerged, and how they are related to these questions of a very important resource, and the elite might be, or other aspects which might be able to distinguish. I don't know, does it make sense to think about different forms, formations of statehood emerging after the end of the Soviet Union in this part of...
Yeah, I mean, I think in relation to the second question, there are whole sort of fields of political science that have tried to sort of think about that, sort of rentier capitalism, for instance, and the forms of authoritarian politics that can develop in oil-rich states, particularly, I mean, the Kazakhstan example would be one that would often kind of be cited there, where there's a very... Turkmenistan as a kind of extreme, where there's a very particular kind of social contract premised upon, to a comparative degree, a kind of material abundance and distribution that is coupled with severe restrictions of the political realm. And that's also a form of sort of vernacular political diagnosis that often the claim is made in Kyrgyzstan, well, we haven't got the resources, we don't have the same state capacity that exists in Kazakhstan, therefore, you know, sort of, there isn't the same kind of capacity to control, for the political field to control the social environment, and that this leads to a more democratic kind of environment. There are lots of counter-arguments that can be made there, and there are lots of, I think, overgeneralizations that are often made about the way in which certain sort of economic formations facilitate certain political outcomes. But certainly that's a very widely held perception, alongside the sense that, well, we've always been democratic because we're nomads, you know, we've never had an overlord. And this is a sort of very powerful aspect of self-identification. But there is also a real desire for a certain kind of political stability. And I think that's why Putin is extremely popular in Kyrgyzstan. And a particular model of... I gave the example of Sadr Agay, who in one of his comments, he said, there's no... there's like no connectivity, there's no kind of... There isn't this sort of connection between those in power and ordinary people. And I think that what's often admired in the case of Russia, for instance, is this feeling that Putin really has control over everything, that there's somebody at the center who can really sort of survey the entire political field. However much of a fiction that is, that's a very, very powerful image that sort of there should be a political center that can... that can control politics, and that there's a kind of anxiety around the volatility of politics and its incapacity to be controlled by the institutional forms that exist. So yeah, I do think that there are interestingly different political formations, but I think that from an anthropological perspective, the modes of reasoning about what accounts for those differences is very, very interesting. And then as regards kind of Apadorai and Hirschman and these modes of sort of political process, yeah, I think it's interesting, this question of exit voice and loyalty, because although it's in one sense it's a sort of it's a heuristic, and therefore, you know, we can sort of complicate it, I do think that actually in many situations it has a kind of it's useful to think with, certainly in this situation, not least because there is a huge amount of political exit. I mean, that one of the ways in which, again, in contemporary Kyrgyzstan, there is a great deal of anxiety about the fact that the country is highly dependent on migrant workers, highly dependent upon remittances, and that many of those migrant workers then end up seeking Russian citizenship, or seek to become permanent residents of Russia, but very often seek citizenship. So there is also a sort of fear about the political, the populace itself being diminished as a result of this political volatility, that it's not just kind of disruptive, but it actually leads to a kind of, you know, more and more people will just leave. And so I think that's another reason why there is this sort of desire to kind of contain the political field as well, because it's seen as having immediate consequences in terms of of exit in Hirschman's terms. I'm not sure whether that exactly captures your...
Well, I was wondering question. If political refusal and exit means kind of the same thing. Or
oh,
if,
I see, or yeah. I would need to go back to Hirschman, I think, to really get how he's using exit, whether he's talking sort of about non-participation or whether he's talking about leaving.
Non-participation.
Okay.
So exit from the political process, in a way.
Yeah.
That's my reading.
Because I think refusal can be that form of exit. I guess I would want it to be more, to include more than that, though, that to include also these forms of action that are not just a sort of non-engagement, but that are an active refusal to take part in a demonstration, for instance, at a point when you're being pressured to take part in one. That seems to be something that's more kind of... That's more actively a political act in its own right, right? The refusal as a kind of form of political action, or at least a form of ethical action. And I'm not sure whether that's fully what kind of Hirschman is getting at with exit, but like I say, it's a long time since I had a look at that text. So I'd need to sort of see how exactly he's theorising this term.
Thank you very much. I was wondering what the role of a Kyrgyzstan-based social science anthropology could be in that, and whether there are intellectual, political voices that you probably also collaborated with, or how this situation was. Probably you talked about that and I overheard it, sorry. But yeah, I think that's also interesting because it's part of the quality of a reflexive field that you enter.
Yes.
Yeah, if you could say.
Sure, yeah. I'm actually really... I used to teach social anthropology in Kyrgyzstan, and I'm fascinated by the formation of social anthropology as a discursive field in Central Asia generally, and Kyrgyzstan specifically. Certainly informally with a lot of, not just social anthropologists, but intellectuals, I've had conversations around these kinds of issues. And I think there's a sort of, this kind of ambivalence, because on the one hand, there's among a lot of intellectuals, especially, a lot of frustration towards, for instance, the very condescending voices that existed in Russia in 2010, saying Kyrgyzstan will never survive as a parliamentary democracy. It can't exist. It's too fragmented. At the same time, and there was an awful lot of prediction at that time that Kyrgyzstan would descend into civil war in the Russian media. It was a very, very dominant discursive framework. This language of failed state came very much from the Russian media, but also from Russian analytical institutes that did these measures of state failure, and Kyrgyzstan was always up among, you know, Zimbabwe and Congo. It was kind of, and there was a sense of outrage among many of my scholar colleagues and friends. So I think there's this sort of ambivalence there. Social anthropology, though, has a very interesting, I think, position within this, that I think, as in many, I would say, not just post-Soviet contexts, but as in many post-colonial contexts, social anthropology has become, as a field, also politicized in a very particular kind of way. In that it's very much bound up with a project of national, ethno-national revivalism, and that means I've had some very, very, very interesting collaborations around, you know, how we think about the field of social anthropology. But I think the field is taught in a very different way, certainly from the way that social anthropology tends to be taught. I can only speak with authority about the UK, but in many Western contexts, I think. And there's also, a very strong sense that social anthropology doesn't study politics. and so I think... that's something that I've often encountered when I've sort of come to Kyrgyzstan doing research in, let's say, political anthropology. I remember being told that, well, you know,
anthropologists don't study borders, you know, and that this was the domain of how anthropology is understood. Also, it's an inheritance of the Soviet ethnographic tradition, that ethnographia was very much the study of particular cultural practices and so on that were very much tied to the identity of a particular ethnic group. So I think it's very interesting the kind of place where these debates happen. I would say tend to be much more among political scientists, among political analysts, within the NGO community, rather than within, let's say, the scholarly discipline of social anthropology, these specific kinds of debates.
Thank you, Madam. We've already run a little bit out of time. I'm sorry, maybe you can pose your question afterwards. I know there was one question left, but I'm
I just wanted to say one short announcement about next week. I just wanted to say that we have a special event again next week, which is the inaugural lecture of our colleague Tahani Nadim. And the important thing to remember is that it will not take part here, but in the room 408 in our main building where we are, in our building, so Morgenstraße 41, and secondly that it takes place at 6 p.m. in the evening. It will be followed by a reception. So, vielen Dank.